back. WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our WNST coverage brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I'm letting myself play. These are real Betty Boop scratch-off tickets. Yes, you can really win 10 grand. We're going to be giving these away downtown at the Land of Kush next Wednesday, the 18th. Vegan crab cake. Well, the Maryland Crab Cake Tour, it's true. All brought to you by our friends at Goodwill Industries as well as Window Nation. We're doing two for ones there. And the Maryland Crab Cake Tour is going to be up and rolling all month long through the city, into the county, and going up to August. We're going to do 31 crab cakes in 31 days again. Because I get thirsty, I'm going to have 31 breweries involved in August. We'll be stopping there as well. I've had a beer with this guy. I've attended a few opening day celebrations at the Old Sports Legends Museum. He has been in my life for as long as I've probably been doing this, as the one-time executive director of the Babe Ruth Museum, now the director emeritus. Some people say I'm sports writer emeritus. Michael Gibbons joins us here to talk all things Bambino, Orioles, Oriole Park, 30 years, and our long, long friendship and a mutual love of sports. What's up, Mike? How are you, man?
Hey, brother. Good to see you, Nash. You know, life just kicks along this emeritus role that I've been wearing for 4 or 5 years now. My intention was to stay involved with the museum because I have a passion for it. I love it. And but we just are trucking along and a lot of work, but it's good work. And, you know, that's the key to everything. I was doing an interview with a guy from the Washington Post the other day, 38-year-old feature writer for the Washington Post. And I said, you must really be good to get up to the land, a job like that. And he said, you know, I've always known that my passion was writing, and I've been chasing after it for a long time. And we talked about that. You obviously have a passion for what you do. I do as well. And I think that we're lucky people, you know, to be able to be involved in something that we love so much. So it's good to catch up with you because you bring the passion every minute, every day.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll say one thing. The last time we got together, this just sort of jogged me. And I guess it was during the plague. We were talking about online and different stuff like that. And I saw that guitar behind you. And there's like a whole like side of you. I don't even know. I've known you 30 years. I don't think I've ever talked any of that with you. And it came up last time. And I didn't even think about it in preparation for this. But like, you got a whole music thing in your life. I just got off of, you know, off the road seeing John Mayer. I mean, music. I'm going to see Pearl Jam later this week. You and I have never talked music, but you're a music guy too, right?
Yeah. I started a band back in 1963, and the band went. And I grew up in a little town called Dickeyville, which is tucked into the northwest corner of the city, over by Woodlawn and stuff like that. But so in Dickeyville, when we were teenagers, we decided we were going to make a band, a folk music band, and call it The Villagers because we lived in Dickeyville. Well, so the band stayed until on
now,
and
were
off.
Were you like a Bo Brummels? Like what kind of band are you in 63? Are you the Beatles? What are you doing?
No, we started as Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul and Mary and Simon and Garfunkel. They were hot. And then the Beatles came along, and so we morphed more into that, but we never lost the folk edge. So we were pretty much
Dylan-y,
relying on harmonies and guitar.
Yeah.
And it was good. But anyway, about, I think in 2016, my son, who is also a musician, like record contract national tour musician, he said to me, Dad, you're getting old. You ought to get the band back together. And so on a lark, I did. And we have played ever since. COVID has slowed things down, and aging, you know, older guys, it makes it more difficult to perform. But we're doing a big show at the B&O Railroad Museum, a fundraiser for St. Jude's Children's Hospital in September. For
I
like
want to come.
People.
I want to come. I want to come. I want to come see the Villagers play.
It's three-part harmony. It's my boy band. we do everything from Traveling Wilburys to the Beatles to Crosby, Stills and Nash and the Eagles. And we're a cover band. So it's been great fun. But thank you for asking. And it's a big part of my life. I think I ended up at the museum and being a writer because I couldn't make it as a musician.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mike, I made it doing this because I couldn't make it as an athlete, right? And I sort of did make it as a writer. But I'm going back to writing. I write all the time. I just haven't been as, and I had John Eisenberg on. I've had John Feinstein on recently, just talking about the loss of a columnist, you know, the loss of a voice for a community in some way, whether it's good, bad, caustic, what I did with Free the Birds, being loud, being, you know, being community oriented the way John Steadman or Jack Murphy, you know, were as sports writers. These are the people that wrote the legend that would allow us to know who Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth are, that would allow little Mikey Gibbons and little Nestor Aparicio to have sports in their life and you to have a museum and for me to still be able to do this 31 years into this, just doing sports. I would say the pathway to all of this and Babe Ruth, I mean, you've had this incredible thing for 30 years with Babe and Baltimore and Cal being here and Brooks still being here and the Colts and the Ravens and all of that. But the Babe Ruth Museum, a lot of people don't, they still haven't been there. They still don't know it's there on Emory Street, right? My dad took me when I was a boy, I know I've told you this. You guys had Harmon Killebrew down there in the day when the Twins were playing at night. And my dad brought me down as a little boy, and I still have the baseball that the killer signed for me. So I've known about it all of my life. It was always in the Junior Oriole. You know, we had a free ticket if you got the Junior Oriole, Crown Gasoline, and all of that stuff back when I was a kid. But you're still extolling the virtues of people that have never seen where Babe Ruth was born. And if you love baseball, you know, still alive and well, everything that you're doing there emeritusly, right?
Yeah, I think that it's important to keep his legacy moving, keep it going. And quite frankly, he does very well on his own. But that's our job, really. That's our mission with the Babe Ruth part of what we do. We've got the number one guy. I think a lot of Baltimoreans look at Babe Ruth as a Yankee, and he is a Yankee. You know, a lot of people who come to see us don't know that he played for the Red Sox, don't know that he was a star pitcher. They know him as the home run hitter of the house that Ruth built and stuff like that, which is a reason that we are into heavy promotion for a new exhibit that we've just opened called The Making of a Legend, which is another look, a different look at why Ruth remains at the top as an American sports cultural icon.
Well, it's been 100 years now, right? You know, we say 1919, and it's been 100 years since the 20s when this went on.
And he flipped over to the Yankees. Yeah.
You know, it's been 30 years since you took me out to West Baltimore to the lot where he played over by the hospital over there and all of that. It's amazing you still discover things, though, right? Like, I guess when you're a historian, you still peel back baseball cards and things that happened 100 years ago that still have relevance for people who love baseball and love the Bambino.
That's true. I'm a historian. I mean, that's a big part of what I do. My title at the museum now is Director Emeritus / Historian. So I'm into the history part of it, and it never ceases to amaze me the new material that we find all the time about Ruth or Johnny Unitas or whatever our subject might be. It just keeps coming out because these are complex individuals. And like you found out about me, I play music in addition to being this sports guy. And Babe Ruth, we're all the same. You know, we have layers of personality and the things that make us up. So it's been fun. Several years ago, a guy got in touch with me via email, and he sent me a postcard. Picture, you know, so he attaches a postcard image, and it shows it's a team picture of boys, teenagers, baseball players. And he said, I think this is Babe Ruth in this picture along with other guys. And he said, this is a picture of an industrial league team in Detroit in 1910. Okay. And that would be astonishing. I was like, that can't be, because Babe Ruth was at St. Mary's Industrial School and it was a prison. He wasn't allowed to leave there. And the guy goes, prove that I'm wrong. Look at the photograph and then I can give you more evidence. Well, it turns out that he was right. Ruth and his team, whatever year that was, so this is 4 years before he signs with the Orioles, so he's 15 years old. There was a school in Detroit by the name of St. Leo's, and it was a sister school to St. Mary's, same kind of setup. And St. Leo's was right across the street from this adding machine manufacturer. And
tell me what St. Mary's was, because sometimes you're into the crosshairs here. You're doing trigonometry, and I'm trying to get to Algebra 1, right?
Don't let me leave the story because it's an incredible story. But
what was St. Mary's
Industrial School?
You said it was like a prison. Explain that to folks.
Well, it was a place. A lot of people thought, well, Babe Ruth was an orphan, that this place was an orphanage. Well, it wasn't. They did have orphaned children, orphaned boys, as part of their student population, which was about 600 kids. But it was also a place for incorrigible children, delinquent children who didn't want to go to school. And so their parents, that was the case with Babe Ruth. Babe didn't like to go to school. And the state in 1902 put out a new law that said, if your children are truant and they don't go to school, we're going to put them into an institution. And so the Ruth family said, well, we don't want that. And they enrolled him into St. Mary's Industrial School. They paid money to have him go there. He was it was run by an order of Catholic brothers, the Xavierin brothers. And so they would get a kid, give him a little discipline, give him some religion, teach him a trade, and how to play a sport. And
let him play ball. Let him play ball.
Let's play ball. So now Ruth becomes this phenom known in the streets of Baltimore. And around 1910, St. Leo's said this Burroughs manufacturing company wants to get a team into the Industrial League and that they wanted to be in. So anyway, Ruth and his entire team, coached by Brother Matthias, the guy that taught Ruth to play baseball at St. Mary's, they went to Detroit for the summer. Think about this.
And you didn't know about this until a couple of years ago.
Nobody knew.
The only reason you knew is there was a picture that existed.
A guy found the photo. And so he did meticulous research, and then we got into it. But you can see Brother Matthias. It's all there. So we verified that Ruth and all these other guys from St. Mary's went out there. They won the manufacturing league, as ringers. So it worked. And then they came back home and nobody knew. Jane Levy, who just wrote The Big Fella a couple of years ago, the new wonderful biography on Ruth, she didn't know because she did research at my place. We didn't know at the time she was doing research. So you find out things and it kind of gets me going a little bit here.
Okay, you get this picture. You're like, do you think this can't be? Or do you think, what is this? When this goes from myth to here's a picture to we're now changing facts. And I don't want to get political, but that happens all the time in our society here, that we mix up what the truth was about anything in this country. But when you come up with this, how do you then, as a historian and as someone that's preaching this as what really happened, how do you piece that together, that this thing happened that summer that you were never aware of before, a couple, two, 3 years ago? Is that when it happened?
Longer than that, but yeah, it hasn't been very long. And so the story has multi-layers to it. So the more you get into it, first of all, we did facial identification on every one of the players in the postcard photograph and compared them with the facial identification of those same boys at St. Mary's.
And you have pictures of those, right?
Yeah. Okay. So we were like, okay, that guy is that guy. You can see it. That's Babe Ruth. There's Brother Matthias, and then we got into the St. Leo's thing. And then we got into Burroughs Manufacturing and the Industrial League and the fact that they won and the record. I think they finished.
Was there anybody in Detroit that had any, was there anything on that side that documented this at all?
Only that postcard and some records that we were able to find about Burroughs Manufacturing baseball team for that year. Unfortunately, the Xavierin brothers, who still exist, that the order still exists, their record keeping is, for that period, is not great. So there's not a ton of stuff, but there is some. And that makes our job more interesting as well, just trying to find things to verify.
I love truth. This, dude, because I feel like I'm talking to the Jacques Cousteau of Babe Ruth now. You know
Jacques
what I mean?
Cousteau,
because you're like peeling back the onion. Well, you know, I love the history of music. So like I would rather read books about how Led Zeppelin was put together or, you know, whatever, or the Eagles or any. I love those rock docs and all that. But from a sports perspective, for this thing to sort of unearth itself 100 years later as to his childhood, which, I mean, let's be honest with Babe, his ascendance, and I guess there was a point in his life when he became Babe Ruth that the documentation of him, he was followed by everyone everywhere, right? The last 30 years of his life were pretty there for everybody to see, right?
The documentation is in for the early times, the Baltimore Times. I mean, we have his marriage certificate from October 1914, when he married Helen Woodford in Ellicott City and at St. Paul's Church, which still stands. And so we have the original marriage certificate, which is like, wow, that's pretty cool. The first professional game that he played for the Orioles in 1914, he pitched and beat Buffalo. We have the official scorebook from that game. I think about that. Who would have known? Who could have thought? Kudos to the Baltimore Sun. They were covering that first team, that Orioles team, where Ruth started in 1914. And they did a really good job. They had a guy down there on the ground reporting by the name of Jesse Linthicum. And Jesse was way into it. And he kept really good records of his time in Fayetteville, North Carolina, covering the Orioles. You see when Babe Ruth was first referred to by the Baltimore Sun as Babe, which occurred like a month into spring training, they're calling him Babe Ruth. It got shortened. He was Jack Dunn's baby. Jack Dunn, the owner, manager of the Orioles, had to sign legal guardian papers to get him out of St. Mary's, and he became Jack Dunn's baby. That's what the players referred to Ruth as, and that shortened to Babe within a month. And it's in the Baltimore Sun. He goes from George Roth, R-O-T-H, to Babe Ruth in a month. And that's how that career exploded.
The Babe Ruth Museum is still down on Emory Street. Anytime you're going down an Oriole game, please stop by. Stop by downtown. We're doing things around town. Mike Gibbons is here, Director Emeritus. Almost makes you feel old a little bit, you know, in that way.
I'm old, baby.
Give me a little primer on the 30 years of Oriole Park at Camden Yards. It went by in a flash. I mentioned
it, dude.
You know, Stedman is always like somewhere, you know, in the air for me, whether it's the books on the shelf behind me or whatnot. But when I think of Camden Yards, and my very first memory of Camden Yards was, I don't know, about 10 days, maybe it wasn't even 10, might have been 3 or 4 before they actually opened it. They had a media thing at 11 in the morning, meet at the home plate plaza. I didn't know where the hell that was. I remember being in that atrium where I was on Thursday night, where we used to get our press passes and take the elevators up and behind it. I walked into that stadium for the first time with John Stedman because it was a media event. We went in together and I wanted to do it with him. It meant something to me. And John and I were very close at that point in my life. I had been working at the paper 8 years at that time, revered John. And we walked around the stadium together that day. And then I remember the Sid Fernandez Mets game in Sutcliffe. But, you know, people have snapshots of all of that. But for it to be 30 years, it's kind of weirded me out. It's making me pinch myself a little bit, Mike.
So the process started with the Orioles to develop a ballpark downtown in 1989. And, you know, there was a possibility that Orioles ownership, Edward Bennett Williams, could have moved the team kind of like Bob Irsay had done in 1984 with the Colts. William Donald Schaefer, the mayor, didn't want that. So got together the Orioles and they start talking. Schaefer says, yeah, we can make this happen. The Orioles got in touch with us at the museum because we were and still are the Orioles Museum. And they said, we need you guys to help. We want to make a retro ballpark, a ballpark that you know, kind of hints at Ebbets Field or Wrigley Field or Fenway Park or what Tiger Stadium, and all those different things. So we worked with Janet Marie Smith to do that. And ultimately were really involved in the whole process. When they built Oriole Park, the Babe Ruth Museum, we brought together a posse of volunteers and they gave guided construction tours. So we went to the site and took people around and all that good stuff. And then when
you
it
know
came
the
to
picture that
the
shows
park,
up is that Randy Milligan. you know, taking that first pitch, that thing shows up all the time. So people, that first pitch when there was no stadium, was just dirt, and you see the Holiday Inn, like literally.
Oh my God.
Pops up, and that's cool.
Well, we've got the bat, we've got the ball, and we've got home plate from that moment, which is kind of cool. But I wrote the dedication speech for Oreo Park that was recited by James Earl Jones two nights before the ballpark opened. We had 4,000 people in the club level. You know, a gala celebration sponsored by the state, by the Orioles and us. And so I got to hang out with James Earl Jones. And this is just a couple of years after the Field of Dreams movie came out. So I thought, well, hell, I'm going to write his speech like it's Baltimore's Field of Dreams. And that's what we did. So fast forward through all of the moments that we've experienced at Oriole Park. And I think in early March, Bill Stetka from the Orioles came to me and said, we want to do an exhibit on the 30 years at Oriole Park. Okay. And we need your help. So we got involved. Bill and I spent hours and hours and hours. He had come up with a shopping list of artifacts that he wanted to display. So we, you know, had to go find them and get them all together and all that. And then he wrote the show. And then we did the exhibit installation at Home Plate Plaza. So when you walk out of that vestibule into the lower concourse, there are 10 exhibit cases that
I saw them all. I was there Thursday night. My wife saw them right away. She's like, wow, look at this. So we saw it all, and it was neat, yeah. Man, really neat.
That was a lot of fun. Greg Schwalenberg, who left the museum several years ago and now works at the Baltimore Zoo, of all places. But I called Greg. I said, we got 10 cases to install in about 2 days, and I need you. So he said, I'm coming, baby. I'm coming. But you talk about Stedman. He is so important to the Baltimore sports scene. I mean, he is like major, major, major important. And people don't know that. They forget that. Most people don't know what a John Stedman was, you know, or is. But he was important. He was a mentor of mine, a mentor of yours. A couple other guys who really helped me. Jim Brady, B-R-E-A-D-Y, who was an editorial writer for the Baltimore Sun. And he wrote The Home Team, that wonderful book on Baltimore baseball. And Jim took me around. You know, I'm 30 some years old. And he goes, you got to go talk to that guy. You got to go talk to Bill Tanton at the Baltimore Sun. You got to go see Bob Brown at the Orioles. And, you know, those people are invaluable, you know, to
well, I knew all those people too as a kid, and you know, their wisdom and their and what Bob Brown's eyes had seen with the Orioles, what Stedman with the Colts on the road, John Zeman, your pal, my pal, our pal, you know, people that lived it, you know, from the inside. I mean, I've had that kind of perspective with the Ravens for the better part of 30 years, and you know,
and you know, we think it's important, and it is, because what we do is we pass along institutional knowledge, the history of our sports town, to the next generation. That's our jobs, really. We do it through using artifacts, right? We take an object, we tell a story. The object helps to interpret the story. You know, so that's how we do that. But I wanted to go back to your point about Baltimoreans not coming to Babe Ruth Museum. And I said, well, he's a Yankee. A lot of the Babe Ruth birthplace, since I've been there, which is 40 years, not 30, the Babe Ruth birthplace has seen close to 2 million visitors. Think about that. You know, that building is not huge. Baltimore is having trouble now, as we know. Baltimore is not getting Baltimore. Local people are not coming downtown as they used to. The new exhibit that we have on the Babe Ruth rookie card and all that $10 million card that we've got, and the way we've displayed it, the hope is that people will come, local people, because they're curious. They want to see
the card. Give me a little story about that.
I will. Yeah. But we've got to do stuff to collectively to turn this city around. I'm thrilled that they're getting ready to start redeveloping Harbor Place. It's the linchpin to making the whole thing work. Connects east and west. We have to do it. The Babe Ruth rookie card, it's a long story, but I'll make it real short. In 1998, a man named Richard Davis came to see Greg Schwalenberg, our curator at the time. And he said, I've got this baseball card of Babe Ruth depicted as a Baltimore Oriole. It's from 1914. Okay, good. So we didn't know about the card. We called the National Baseball Hall of Fame. We knew the curators up there. We said, you guys ever heard of a 1914 Orioles card? No. So we put it on display. It was a curiosity piece, right? The guy said, my father, who collected the card when in 1914, Archibald Davis, he wanted the cards and to be shown at the Babe Ruth Museum. So he put them on indefinite loan. We made an exhibit. And then over time, more information came out about the card. The fact that it was extremely rare. There were only 10 known to exist in captivity. So that makes it rare. And it was Babe Ruth.
Another card did appear. So like when you only see one, you're like, is this real? What was this? How come there's nothing to compare it to? When you start finding multiples, right?
We had heard that over time, and I'm talking like 10, 15 years, we find out that there are other cards, not many, but other. And so there were 14 other Oreo cards in that set that the man brought to Greg. And so we put those cards on display as well. One was of Jack Dunn, the guy who signed Babe Ruth, who discovered Babe Ruth. So that was kind of cool. But the other teammates that were depicted, there was nobody who you would know. No famous baseball players to speak of. But in 2009, the story's going to get close to finishing here, Forbes magazine came out with an article proclaiming that a Babe Ruth rookie card would be more valuable than a Honus Wagner T206 tobacco card. Honus Wagner, that was the Mona Lisa of baseball cards.
Always has been, right.
So now Forbes says, if you have a pristine Babe Ruth and a pristine Honus Wagner, the Ruth card is going to go, and this is in 2009, for maybe $3.8 million, Wagner for about 3.4. Okay, so they're close, but Ruth is considered more valuable. Our card was not pristine. It was a good condition card. So the card stayed on display. We dialed up a little better exhibit for it when Forbes came out with that proclamation to try and draw attention to it, and we did. We promoted it. Then we get up to the pandemic, and the Davis family calls me and says, we're going to sell the card. And over time, they did. The new owner came to collect the card in, I'm going to guess, May, about a year ago, 2021. And he spent the day with us. And he said, you know what? I think I want the card and its mates, the other 14, to be on display at the Babe Ruth Museum. The public needs to see the card. It's important. We went, okay, but because and the value of the card was guessed to be somewhere between $6 and $8 million. That's what the guy paid a year ago. The guy said, I want to remain anonymous, but I said, I have no budget to build the kind of exhibit that needs to house an $8 million card. So he said, I'll take care of that. Well, he did. He paid for a large portion of the exhibit. Other sponsors got involved. The card went on display on April 15th. And it is stunning. It's amazing to do. Huge security, brand new casework, so that because you have to protect it. We got a company out of Boston that had built a case to house the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech, valued at $21 million. So we thought if they can build a case to protect that document, they can build our case for the rookie card and its mates. So when you come down to see it, I think you'll like it. We have a video that goes with it about what is it about baseball cards that makes them so important to the culture of collectibles, right? They're more.
Well, I was a baseball card guy. Anybody that knows me knows that. So I've loved baseball cards since all of my life. So my wife still, we're at the farmer's market in Dundalk. I still want to stop and look at them, you know, no matter what. You know, when I get sent these, hang on, I'll go off camera, but my friends from Hunt Auction send me something like this, and I get to look through here. I will sit here. There's a Luis Aparicio. Mine was stolen. All my Aparicio stuff was stolen at the radio station years ago. And there's an Aparicio 56 rookie card that's up, you know. So I love sports. I love music just like you. Mike Gibbons is down at the Babe Ruth Museum. He is director emeritus. I still think you're pretty relevant. Emeritus makes it feel like you're just like hovering in and just not doing a lot, but I'm glad you hovering, are doing honey. A lot, man. And I'm glad
working,
the band's
baby.
Working. The Villagers are out there, you know, rocking that the three-part harmony. And Maybe you and I'll get a crab cake and a beer together. I get you a lottery ticket. What do you think?
Love to, babe. Love to. Anytime. Yeah. Well, I want to get you down to see the new display. It's pretty cool. And, we got lots of stuff down there. It was a Colts Super Bowl V trophy right next to the Orioles 83 World Series trophy. There they are in a case. You can see that's the only place in America where you will see a Super Bowl trophy and a World Series trophy in the same space. Because teams keep their own, right? But right. We represent the Colts. We represent the Orioles. That's the way it works.
Beautiful.
That's
beautiful.
All good.
Hey, man, get down. Support Mike Gibbons. Mike, you're 2.5 blocks from Fadley's. You'll see me. Don't. I will not be a stranger. I get my face in the place down on Emory Street. Big appreciation to Mike Gibbons, as always, for coming on. 31 years now I've been doing this. I think 31 years Mike Gibbons has been coming on with me. Probably met him back in 1992 when the stadium had just opened and we had things going on and it was exciting. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking Baltimore positive.